I want to thank also Richard von Bremen and Professor Maria Clara Franco for organizing a spectacular meeting. And especially my thanks go to Richard for inviting me to come to this conference and visit for the first time not only the Linus Pauling Institute, but Corvallis, which I assure you is far more peaceful than Los Angeles, where I'm from. And I want to welcome all of you to this lecture. I know some of you are scientists, the remains of the end of the present conference, and plus this was open to the public, so there are some people in the audience who are not scientists. So when I give my presentation, I promise to make it as contain as little science as possible. I might just divert a little bit in, on certain slides to explain some of the chemistry, so hopefully the non-scientists will forgive me for doing this. But again, it's a great honor and a pleasure to be here, so I'm going to start my presentation. Let's see if I can do this correctly. There we go. So I'm going to talk to you about a molecule called nitric oxide, which in my opinion is a truly remarkable molecule. And often when I give this talk, I title the talk, The Road to Stockholm, a Nobel Mission. And I think you'll see what I mean as I go through this. But I want to start off by describing some of my interests and hobbies as a young child, because I think that this is pertinent to what I have to say today. But I was always interested in chemistry, believe it or not, even when I was 10 years old. And I enticed my parents to buy me a chemistry set, and I remember it was a Gilbert chemistry set. And my parents were immigrants from Italy. They never received a formal education. They never even went to the first grade. My dad was a carpenter. My mom had to stay home and take care of my brother and I and do all the cooking for my hardworking father. That's the way it was back in the 1940s in the New York City area. So my dad had no problems with my getting chemistry set. He didn't understand it, and he thought that, well, we should allow our sons to do whatever they want to do. So my mom, though, of course, questioned that. She said to me, what are you going to do with the chemistry set? I said, I'm going to read the manual, and I'm going to do some experiments with the chemicals that come with the chemistry set. And she said, at 10 years old, you're going to do that? And I said, yes, Mom, really. So they bought me the chemistry set. But of course, I had some devious goals, like making rocket fuel and firecrackers, which I successfully did. However, the chemistry set didn't come with some of those chemicals. So I had to entice my older friends who had brothers to go to the local pharmacies to get some chemicals. And back then, the pharmacies had all these chemicals because they compounded prescriptions. They made them. They didn't get them from a drug company and then pour them in another bottle and then put a label on it and give it to you. I mean, they actually compounded them. So that was my first encounter with things like sulfur, charcoal powder, and potassium nitrate. And I actually developed an understanding of these chemicals and how to mix them together just right. So I want to say something about Linus Pauling, not only because I'm here, but because I had an encounter with him, as you heard. So Linus Pauling received he was awarded the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 54, and then in 1962, the Peace Prize for his opposition to weapons of mass destruction. The Chemistry Prize was for his research into the nature of the chemical bond and its application to the elucidation of the structure of complex substances. One of his greatest accomplishments was to show for the first time the structure of proteins and their spiral nature. And this discovery led to subsequent discoveries as well that others made, involving, for example, the DNA double helical structure and so on. He was quite a chemist, quite a scientist. And my encounter with Linus Pauling, as you heard, was when I was a junior or third year high school student in 1956. I was 15 years old, and I questioned my teacher as to why we didn't have a chem lab. We had a physics course and a physics lab. We had a chemistry course, but no chem lab. And, you know, I love playing with chemicals. I wanted a chemistry lab. I was very disappointed. And so I asked the teacher, how do you expect to teach chemistry without a laboratory? I said it politely, though, not like that. And so he heard me. A few weeks later, he told me he had a surprise. He's going to invite a famous chemist, friend of his, to come to the school for a few hours or a day to help us, give us some advice as to how to set up the laboratory. And when I asked him who it was, he said that it was Professor Linus Pauling. And I was really surprised, because, and the teacher was surprised that I knew of his name. I had been reading chemistry books, so of course I knew who he was, and I knew that he was awarded the Nobel Prize just recently, which was actually 2 years before that. So he helped to set up the laboratory, and what I was most taken by him is just the way he talked to me and some of the other students. He had a way of describing and explaining chemistry, elementary chemistry, of course, but in a way that was very easy to understand. And he was very motivating. And I think that when I think about it, he certainly was one of the most important motivating factors in my success as a chemical pharmacologist. Pharmacology is the study of drugs on living tissues. And many people take a physiological approach to studying pharmacology, or a biochemical approach. But he influenced me so much in chemistry, I wanted to take a chemical approach, which was pretty new at the time that I went to graduate school. And I was very lucky that when I did my postdoc at the NIH had just established a new lab called the Laboratory of Chemical Pharmacology. So I applied there, got in, and I learned even more about chemical applications to pharmacology. So I'm going to talk to you about the history and discovery of this unique molecule, which, by the way, is a gaseous molecule, like oxygen, carbon dioxide, nitrogen. NO is a gas. Now, it doesn't work as a gas in the body. Oxygen doesn't work as a gas in the body. These gases are soluble in liquids, in water, in the blood, and so on. So they work in solution. They don't float around as bubbles producing effects in the body. So this molecule is nitric oxide, also abbreviated NO. And this is, I don't think you have to be a chemist to understand this. This is a very simple molecule. It consists of one atom of nitrogen and one atom of oxygen, very simply. But it's more complex than meets the eye, especially if you're not a scientist. This is what we call a radical, a free radical. And the reason is that it has this electron. Atoms and molecules have electrons that rotate around them. And in most cases, when the molecules are stable, they need to have two electrons paired together like this. However, when you have one single electron by itself, these molecules are very unstable. They don't like to exist in that form. They're always running around looking for other molecules that also have a single electron so they can react in order to form an electron pair, and that makes them stable. And so for that reason, nitric oxide is fairly reactive, which accounts for all the different things that it does in the body, as I will explain to you. And I think that nitric oxide is the most widespread signaling molecule in the body, and I hope to convince you of that. It's also, I think, the most widespread anti-aging molecule in the body. Having said those two, what I come to realize is that it's really nice when you're a Nobel laureate, because you can say whatever you want, and very few people question you. So how does nitric oxide elicit its effects in the body? Well, there are probably two major mechanisms. One is because of the chemistry of nitric oxide. As I explained earlier, it's reactive. It can undergo direct chemical interactions with a variety of other molecules and bind to those other molecules and alter the function of those other molecules. But another mechanism, the first one described, and one that I was involved with very early on, is that it can stimulate the production in cells of another signaling molecule, which has the name of cyclic GMP. And this is a signaling molecule inside cells. And so nitric oxide can activate an enzyme. The name of the enzyme is guanylate cyclase. You don't have to ever remember that. It's kind of a tongue twister. But this enzyme catalyzes the formation of cyclic GMP in cells. And it kind of looks like this, if I may show this cartoon or schematic. But this enzyme actually can catalyze the conversion of something called GTP to the important molecule here, cyclic GMP. Enzymes are like catalysts. They speed up a reaction. Nitric oxide can activate this enzyme guanylate cyclase so that the enzyme actually makes 300 or 400-fold more nitric cyclic GMP than in the absence of the nitric oxide. So that's really one of the main mechanisms of nitric oxide in the body. So whatever effects that nitric oxide produces, many of those effects are actually produced by cyclic GMP. In other words, NO activates the enzyme, it elevates cyclic GMP, and it's the cyclic GMP that produces some of the effects. This is very popular in biochemistry and physiology. A cascade of reactions, and then the final step actually is the response, so to speak. So we were doing that work at about 1979, 1980, and that's when we also started to look at nitroglycerin. So let me explain nitroglycerin. You all know this. Nitroglycerin is both a drug, right, and an explosive. Nitroglycerin is the active explosive in dynamite that Alfred Nobel invented back in the 1800s. But nitroglycerin is also a drug, right? It comes as tablets, and if you place those tablets under your tongue, if you're suffering from angina pectoris or chest pains due to an impending heart attack, nitroglycerin dilates certain blood vessels and just kind of relieves the stress on the heart, and that pain disappears. So this, so when you widen the arteries or cause the drop in blood pressure, this is what we call a vasodilator effect. And this vasodilator effect of nitroglycerin was actually discovered in Alfred Nobel's dynamite factories. So when the workers came into the factories, they noted that on Mondays when they began their job, they would develop tremendous migraine-like headaches, which lasted all week until they went home on the weekend. In addition, people with chest pains noticed that the pains would disappear while they were working in the dynamite factories, but on the weekends those pains would come back. And that's due to the fact that nitroglycerin is a volatile liquid. In other words, fumes can come off the nitroglycerin, get into the air, people can breathe those fumes. And so because of the vasodilator effect on the cerebral arteries, you can get a headache. And because the nitroglycerin is a vasodilator in the peripheral vessels near the heart, that can relieve the anginal pain, if you will. But the mechanism of action of nitroglycerin as a vasodilator remained unknown for well over 100 years until we worked it out in our lab. And we often asked the question, could nitroglycerin work by a nitric oxide cyclic GMP mechanism? And the reason we brought that up, I'll show you. In other words, we asked the question, could nitroglycerin work by being converted or metabolized to nitric oxide, let's say, in blood vessels? And the reason I thought that is just by looking at the chemical structure. So here's where there's a little bit of science, and I'm going to focus a little bit on the scientists in the audience. So this is nitroglycerin. We have a 3-carbon backbone, and we have 3 nitrate ester groups. And of course, as you can see, these are ester groups, nitrate esters. It's not a nitrate. The oxygen actually acts as a bridge between the carbon and the nitrogen. The nitrogen is not bound directly to the carbon. So it's an estrogen. But before I describe the experiment we did, let me just show you how nitroglycerin has been synthesized as an explosive ever since the days of an Italian, his name was Ascanio Sobrero, who actually first synthesized nitroglycerin. but he had so many accidents and explosions he couldn't contain it. It was Alfred Nobel who then worked with nitroglycerin and figured out how to make it safe by developing or inventing dynamite. But anyway, the way you make nitroglycerin simply is you take the starting material, glycerol. This is a very safe substance. This is like an alcohol or a sugar. It's actually very sweet. It's a thick liquid. You could put it on your tongue. It's very sweet. It's used in many pharmaceutical preparations to sweeten the flavor of bad-tasting cough syrups and so on and so forth. So it's very safe. The nitroglycerin is made by adding glycerol to a mixture of two substances that are not so safe. And these are concentrated nitric acid and concentrated sulfuric acid. When these three are mixed together, the result is this trinitroglycerol or nitroglycerin. It's a very simple reaction. The only requirement for this reaction is that it be conducted carefully. So if we get back to nitroglycerin, we suspected that maybe NO could be formed from nitroglycerin. If you look at one of these groups here, you could see that the NO is sort of built into the molecule. And so we had an idea that one of these or all of these might actually somehow be converted to NO. And without explaining any details, that's what we found. We found that when nitroglycerin comes in contact, for example, with vascular arterial tissues, smooth muscle, the result is a formation of NO, and this is the second product of the reaction. It's the dinitro alcohol, if you will. And this product here is not active as a vasodilator. It's nitric oxide that's, you know, quite active as a vasodilator. And about the same time, this was 1980, we made another discovery that nitric oxide can inhibit the clotting of human blood. And it can do that by inhibiting the function of platelets. It prevents platelet aggregation. When your blood clots, usually at a site of injury somewhere, the platelets stick to the inside of the blood vessel and they begin to clump together and form a plug, which gets larger and larger and then actually plugs the injury so that you don't have a massive loss of blood. Well, nitric oxide can inhibit that entire process. And its mechanism is through the cyclic GMP that I was talking about. So by 1980, this was the pharmacology of NO, which I thought was very interesting. It's a vascular smooth muscle relaxant. That means vasodilator. But it's also non-vascular smooth muscle relaxant. It could relax the tracheal smooth muscle or the bronchi smooth muscle. In other words, it can relax airway smooth muscle, even gastrointestinal smooth muscle. Any smooth muscle can be relaxed by nitric oxide. And when you test it in the animal, it's a vasodilator. It lowers the blood pressure, especially when the blood pressure is elevated, like in hypertension. And because it's a vasodilator, it improves local blood flow to different organs in the body. And I already told you it inhibits blood clotting. And all of these effects are mediated by cyclic GMP. So this was beginning to become a really fascinating story that we have. When you add nitric oxide to human tissues, you can elevate cyclic GMP and produce all of these effects. But the one thing that bothered me was the physiological relevance of nitric oxide. So let me explain to those of you who don't work in the laboratory or clinically. Pharmacology means the effect of the chemical or drug on the cells, on the tissues. That's an outside chemical. You add it to tissues, you get an effect. That's a pharmacological effect. Physiological effect means something exists in the body and then interacts with other cells in the body and produces an effect or response. That's physiological because it's inside the body. So what about nitric oxide? At this point in time, NO is not known to exist in the mammalian species. It was well known to be a gas in the Earth's atmosphere. It occupies quite a high percentage of gas in the atmosphere. And in the atmosphere, nitric oxide reacts with oxygen to form NO2, or nitrogen dioxide, also known as acid rain. not a very safe gas to be around. And because of that well-known reaction, no one even suspected that NO would be present endogenously, that is, inside mammals. No one was thinking about nitric oxide as a naturally occurring signaling molecule. And so nobody was thinking about the physiological relevance of nitric oxide. But in our laboratory discussions, you know, we always said, wait, not so fast. I mean, why would a pure outside exogenous molecule be such a potent vasodilator? Nitric oxide works at very, very, very low concentrations to produce this effect. Also, why would well-defined receptors exist for nitric oxide inside cells? And those receptors are on guanylate cyclase. Remember I said NO activates, it binds to and activates guanylate cyclase to elevate cyclic GMP. Why would we have receptors on guanylate cyclase to react to a chemical that's only present in the atmosphere? That didn't make sense. And so we thought, well, you know, maybe NO does exist in cells, but we just did not know that at the time. Certainly if NO existed in cells, that would explain the physiological relevance of the NO cyclic GMP system. But our conclusions, nevertheless, were that the chemistry of NO revealed that it was highly unlikely that NO could exist, much less function, in mammalian cells because it's too unstable and highly reactive with other molecules. But then something happened, also in 1980. Someone else made another discovery. His name was Robert Furchgott, or Bob Furchgott. So the discovery he made appeared to have nothing to do with nitric oxide at the time. And what he did is he showed the mechanism of vasodilation by another molecule called acetylcholine. Acetylcholine is a chemical in the body that's released from many different nerves that causes vasodilation inside the animal. But whenever people would try to see if acetylcholine could cause relaxation of the artery in vitro, outside the animal, it would never work. And Bob Furchgott figured out how he can get it to work. That took about 100 years. Not of his own time, of course, but you know, since acetylcholine was first tested. And so what I want to do is I want to take you through a series of cartoons or schematics that will eventually illustrate our progression of thinking or thoughts that culminated in our discovery that nitric oxide is indeed an endogenous signaling molecule. So allow me, please, to take you through this chronologically. This is like it is the first setup, the first experiment that Bob Furchgott did. This is he would take a small segment of artery and then, using a very sharp razor, make rings, cross-section rings, and then put each in a tissue bath and hook it up so that you could record contraction or relaxation. Then he would add various drugs and chemicals to that to see whether the rings would relax or contract. And it's a pretty good way to study vascular function. So this schematic shows a cross-section of that. This would be where the blood flows. See, this is the lumen of the blood vessel where the blood flows. This would be one of many layers of smooth muscle cells. When those cells are relaxed, the artery dilates or widens, vasodilation. When those muscle cells contract, you get vasoconstriction or tightening of the blood vessel. And there are many layers of smooth muscle cells, but the endothelial cells or endothelium consists only of a single layer of cells that separate the blood from the underlying smooth muscle. So what Bob Furchgott found was that when he added acetylcholine, that's abbreviated ACH, he got a relaxation as long as the endothelial cells were present. And he showed by experimentation that acetylcholine elevated something in the endothelial cells. He didn't know what it was, so he called it endothelium-derived relaxing factor because it was a relaxing factor that came from the endothelial cells. And somehow this EDRF moved into the smooth muscle to cause relaxation. Now, he did some really interesting experiments. If he took, for example, a cotton swab and he gently removed the endothelial cells without hurting the smooth muscle cells, if he did that and then added acetylcholine, there was no relaxation. So the relaxation was endothelium dependent, and some relaxing factor was being made in the endothelial cells. That's why he called it EDRF, or endothelium-derived relaxing factor. He had no idea what it was. And he tried to determine what it was, and he couldn't, because when the EDRF is made, it lasts for 1 or 2 seconds and then it vanishes. It's destroyed. And so you need more than a couple of seconds to be able to isolate something and identify it. That's why he couldn't do it. But a lot of other laboratories tried to, you know, repeat his experiments, which we all did, and then we went after EDRF to see what it might be. So one of the first experiments we did, we knew that cyclic GMP was involved in vasodilation, in relaxation, right? We had just shown that for nitric oxide. Elevate cyclic GMP causes relaxation. So we measured cyclic GMP levels, and we found that they went up. Great. But that does not tell you that cyclic GMP was responsible for the relaxation. It just tells you that acetylcholine in the presence of the endothelium can elevate cyclic GMP. But we had to determine whether the cyclic GMP was actually causing the relaxation or was going up for some other reason. And so we figured if cyclic GMP was going up, that that enzyme guanylate cyclase that I talked to you about, you know, must be there in order to raise cyclic GMP. So we tested an inhibitor of this enzyme guanylate cyclase, which happens to be called methylene blue. So when we added methylene blue to this system, what happens is we were able to block, these hash marks means blockade, we blocked the ability of acetylcholine to elevate cyclic GMP, and by blocking cyclic GMP, we also blocked relaxation. So that told you that cyclic GMP is required for the relaxation, and that guanylate cyclase, which I abbreviate GC, must be here. So when you look at this, you're thinking, well, okay, whatever this EDRF is, it must be activating this guanylate cyclase to increase cyclic GMP and cause relaxation. And this whole process, once again, was endothelium dependent. Well, at the time, the only other substance I knew of that could activate guanylate cyclase, elevate cyclic GMP, and cause relaxation was what? Nitric oxide. I told you about that. So if we, in this experiment, if we add nitric oxide is a very small lipid-soluble molecule. That means it can diffuse through all the membranes. It just goes sailing through membranes. So nitric oxide can get into the smooth muscle to elevate cyclic GMP and cause relaxation. Nitric oxide does not need the endothelium to do this. It's endothelium independent. It just gets right in and produces cyclic GMP and relaxation. So take a look at these data. I took a good look at this data, trying to conclude what EDRF might be. So having this all in front of you, if you would look at this data, what do you think the chemical nature of EDRF is? What does it resemble? Well, clearly it resembles nitric oxide. Clearly it resembles nitric oxide. So we were lucky that we did these experiments. But you know, before we could publish such a provocative conclusion, I mean, you can't publish provocative conclusions unless you have the experimental evidence to back it up. So we had to quickly design some chemical experiments and other biochemical, pharmacological experiments to show the identity of the EDRF. And when we did that, we could see that EDRF was clearly nitric oxide, which I have to admit came as somewhat of a surprise. But then once we looked at all the data, it was not that surprising. Of course, you're always surprised when you see something for the first time. But now, what we can do is, you see this EDRF, we don't have to use that anymore. We can now change it to NO, because EDRF is NO. And this was the first demonstration that mammalian cells could actually produce nitric oxide. And remember, earlier I said, because of the chemistry of NO, NO could never exist inside cells, much less work as a signaling molecule. And the one thing I learned from this experiment, as well as many others in my lifetime, is never say never. Just do the experiments. And we got into looking at, so as I said, this was the first demonstration that NO does exist in cells. We looked at antioxidants, and the reason we did that was because in order for us to identify EDRF, we had to stabilize it somehow, make it stick around for maybe 20, 30 seconds instead of 2 or 3 seconds. That would give us enough time to do our reactions to try to identify the EDRF. And so we had to add antioxidants, or reducing agents, if you will, to enable this identification. We tested a whole bunch of different ones. And I'm not going to rattle them off here, because we have a lot of people who won't understand that. But suffice it to say that the most effective antioxidant that we used in our hands was good old ascorbic acid, or vitamin C. And for those of you who are interested, we had 5 millimolar ascorbic acid present. We tried a variety of other ones. They didn't work. Oh, they worked a little bit. But vitamin C was great. And today, back then we didn't have all these polyphenolic antioxidants like ellagic acid and pomegranates, or all the polyphenols, the other antioxidants we heard about from blueberries and so on. I'm sure they would all work, and probably better, perhaps, than vitamin C. I'm not sure. Nobody's ever done these experiments. And so once we made this discovery, of course, many, many people jumped into the field. I mean, we had a new player on the block. Nitric oxide produced in mammalian cells, my goodness, what else can it do? And on and on. How is it made? We didn't show how it was made. We just showed that it was made. Then many incredible laboratories, not mine, jumped into the field and described the enzymes that exist to make nitric oxide. And this is called NO synthase, is the name of the enzyme. And I'm showing this reaction. I don't want anybody who's not a scientist to leave the room, but some of you others may be interested. But nitric oxide comes from a very simple amino acid that we consume every time we have protein. Arginine is one of 20 or so amino acids present in proteins that we have in the body, proteins that we consume. And one of these amino groups here actually is converted to nitric oxide, leaving you with the second product of the reaction, which is another amino acid called citrulline. And so the sequence of steps, which I will not explain, I'll explain it to you later if you'd like, but the first step is a conversion of the NH to the NOH, and then the next step is putting the oxygen on this molecule to form citrulline, and then the N is cleaved, removed from here, to produce nitric oxide. And really, that's the major reaction, and I'm not going to say more about that. Now, here's a slide maybe I should have shown you at the beginning, so I apologize, but this is another cartoon of a cross-section of the artery, okay? So we have the blood that's in the lumen that circulates, right? Hemoglobin, that's what makes it red. And then we have the smooth muscle cells here. When they relax, the vessel widens or dilates, vasodilation. When these muscles contract, you get vasoconstriction. It tightens. Vasoconstriction increases blood pressure. Vasodilation lowers blood pressure. The endothelial cells I was talking about form a single layer right here as a barrier between the blood and the smooth muscle cells. Every single endothelial cell makes NO. The average adult has 60 trillion endothelial cells. Now, don't ask me how they counted them. I have no idea, but you can estimate that. And what the nitric oxide does, and this diagram is a little bit incorrect. I kind of plagiarized this from another book, but the endothelial cells make NO, and that NO diffuses backwards into the muscle cells to relax them. The NO also diffuses in the front of the endothelial cells, right at the barrier between blood and endothelial cell. And very importantly, that nitric oxide prevents platelets from sticking to the surface. You don't want your blood to clot for no apparent reason. I mean, that would cause a heart attack, a stroke, and other things. Nitric oxide protects against that. Also, the nitric oxide released by the endothelial cells prevents other cell type from getting through into the smooth muscle. That could cause cholesterol plaque deposition, atherosclerosis, coronary artery disease. NO is very protective against that. Sometimes I think the most important effect of NO is as an anti-inflammatory to prevent inflammation of the arterial wall, even more importantly than as a regulator of blood pressure. Again, that's my opinion, and I can say whatever I want, as I told you earlier. But this arrow shows NO going into the blood. It really doesn't do that. When NO goes into the blood, it's immediately destroyed within nanoseconds because NO reacts with hemoglobin, oxyhemoglobin. When hemoglobin binds oxygen, if NO hits that hemoglobin, it's immediately destroyed. So NO can't travel down the bloodstream to produce an effect anywhere. The hemoglobin is what keeps the action of nitric oxide local, right at the spot that it is produced. It's sort of like a locally acting hormone or substance. Okay, so I hope you understood that. Now I jump to something a little different because it's another discovery we made, this time in 1990. We discovered the nitric oxide as the principal neurotransmitter in mediating erectile function. Now, why in the world would we do that experiment? You know, jumping from the heart and blood vessels to erectile tissue. Well, because one day, a urologist friend of mine at UCLA came down to ask me what the neurotransmitter was in the nerves that innervate the erectile tissue, or corpus cavernosum. I said, what are you asking me? You're the urologist. I don't know. And he said, well, I thought, you know, you might know because you're working with nitric oxide and cycle of GMP. He really didn't have any suggestions. And anyway, I thought about this that afternoon and thought, well, I wonder if it might be nitric oxide because when the nerves are stimulated in the erectile tissue, there's a relaxation not only of the vascular smooth muscle, the arteries, but also the non-vascular smooth muscle, lots of non-vascular smooth muscle arranged in a cavernous network in the erectile tissue. And I thought, you know, maybe it could be NO. So anyway, to make a long story short, he helped us set up isolated segments of corpus cavernosum in the laboratory, and we electrically stimulated them on and on and on, and we discovered that nitric oxide was the neurotransmitter that mediates erectile function or penile erection. And so we published the first study in rabbits in 1990, and then the other paper on human tissue got accepted to the only article I ever had in the New England Journal of Medicine, which, as you know, is a very prestigious journal. It's even more prestigious when a PhD gets an article in there. And this was January 9th, 1992. And the New England Journal of Medicine is linked to the news media. In other words, the news media gets the actual list of the publications and articles one day prior to the appearance of that particular issue of the journal. So on the morning, the next morning, I received all kinds of phone calls from the news media, radio, TV, magazines, journals. And the first phone call I got was from the editor of Hustler magazine. And I was wondering whether or not I should conduct this interview. I was ready to do so, but then I remembered that my mother was still alive and doing well at that time, and I figured all that she would need to hear about was her son conducting an interview with the editor of Hustler magazine. That would not be a nice thing to do to her. What the hell would she discuss with the neighbors? But I did accept the next interview with the New York Times. And you know, I think it's great when a pharmacologist makes the left-hand column of the front page of the New York Times. And this was when President Bush Sr. existed in office. And so it was a nice coverage of the of our work, with an occasional mistake, you know, by the editor with a typesetter calling nitric oxide sometimes nitric acid. Ouch. Anyway, there was a similar article that was published in an Italian newspaper, and I'm Italian, of course, and I can tell you that Italians often express themselves better in pictures than in words. So in the article was a cartoon, and that cartoon shows a gentleman in bed with his lady, and what I was afraid of is this: he's wearing a nitric oxide gas tank. And the writing on there is in Italian, of course, and it's ossido d'azoto. That means nitric oxide, or oxide of nitrogen. And I can't begin to tell you what my mom thought about that cartoon. And a couple of months after that article appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine, the journal Science decides to declare nitric oxide as molecule of the year. Very humorous. But what happened 6 years later? The article was published in 92. 6 years later is 98. That's not that long after that. So what happens? Sildenafil gets marketed by Pfizer Pharmaceuticals as Viagra. And so the mechanism of action, I'm not going to get into that here, but the mechanism of action of Viagra translates to be an increase in the actions of cyclic GMP and nitric oxide. So it was really great to see that. I remember when that report came out while I was watching TV one day. And so let's look at the dates more closely. It was in March of 98 that Viagra was marketed. And just a few months later, in October of the same year, the Nobel Prize for nitric oxide gets announced. I thought, is this a coincidence or what? So I decided to look up the committee members of the Nobel Committee for Physiology or Medicine, and I found that the majority of them were men over the age of 60. It's perfect. So let me tell you something about the Nobel Prizes. There are six categories. Most people who are not scientists, you know, always hear about the Nobel Peace Prize. Many times I am congratulated for winning the Nobel Peace Prize. Those of you who know me know that I could never win a Nobel Peace Prize, for sure. But there are one prize is called Physiology or Medicine. It's not that Alfred Nobel couldn't make up his mind, but what he meant to say is physiology, you know, and or medicine, I guess. There's one in physics, one in chemistry, one in literature, as you know, one in economic sciences, and one in peace. And this is what the Nobel Prize looks like. And maybe you've seen Linus Pauling's two prizes. I only have one, but you know, let me tell you, one's enough. And so the front of the coin, this is my prize, shows Alfred Nobel, born 1833, passed away 1896. And then on the opposite side is the symbol or image for physiology or medicine. And you can't see it from there, but my name is here, and the date 1998 is there for when I received the prize. So often when I speak, people ask me, how do you get the Nobel Prize? And I always tell them, I have no idea. But let me just go over some of the criteria. For the medicine prize and also physics and chemistry, there's two major requirements established by Alfred Nobel, who put these in his last will and testament just before he passed away in 1896. And one is you have to have made an original discovery. It makes no difference how much you have extended or advanced a field. You have to have discovered the field. That's a big difference. And not only do you have to have discovered something, but you have to show its benefit to humankind. So in terms of what I've done, so what is the original discovery? Well, I've told you about that. Nitric oxide is produced by mammalian cells, number one, and it functions as a unique signaling molecule to regulate and control a multitude of different physiological actions. Now, the benefit to humankind, again, as you've heard, there's quite a few. NO controls blood pressure, blood flow, blood clotting. We know now that endothelial cells make NO to prevent stroke, prevent heart attack, and so on. Another benefit to humankind was NO is the mediator of penile erection and sexual arousal. I don't know about you, but I think that discovery alone is worth the Nobel Prize. NO controls bladder function, GI function. I mean, it does so many things. Many of these, of course, I had nothing to do with. Other people who jump on the bandwagon afterwards made these discoveries. And NO is a pretty good universal anti-inflammatory molecule. Depends how you look at it. Mechanisms vary, but it has the chemistry of being an anti-inflammatory molecule. Now, every year when there's a Nobel Prize, the Nobel Foundation has artists who make a poster of that particular Nobel Prize. So this was for 1998. That I shared the prize with Bob Furchtgott, I told you, who discovered EDRF. I identified EDRF as NO and did the other things I told you about. And Fred Murad started the whole field. He was the one who first showed that nitric oxide could stimulate guanylate cyclase to elevate cyclic GMP. So you can see how the Nobel Committee members, you know, put the three of us together. We didn't work together. If anything, we were competitors, especially this character at the end and me. But yet, we were able to solve these problems. So what this poster shows, and it's supposed to be shown to people who are not scientists. That's what the Nobel Foundation does with their posters. So this coronary artery from this heart is very healthy, lots of space for the blood to flow through. There's no inflammation of the wall. There's no atherosclerosis, no cholesterol plaques. This artery came from a healthy person eating a healthy diet and having lots of physical activity. On the other hand, this artery, a very sick artery, probably came from someone who led a sedentary lifestyle, you know, eating a lot of hamburgers and fries and so on and so forth, not a healthy diet. And you can see the cholesterol plaques in the lumen. You can see the overgrowth of the smooth muscle cells here compared to here. This all impinges on the space for the flow of blood. So the lumen gets smaller and smaller until finally no blood can flow through. If that happens in the heart, you get a heart attack. If that happens in the brain, you can get a stroke. Also, some of these cholesterol plaques can come loose and circulate all through the body. And wherever they deposit, especially in the brain, that can cause a stroke and other problems. So, in ending this presentation, I just have a few more minutes. I wanted to describe to you where I was when I first heard about the Nobel Prize, which was on October 12, 1998. I was not home. I was in the middle of teaching a pharmacology course. I was course director, and I took a break in October to go to Italy to give a lecture. I didn't know that they were going to make a decision about the Nobel Prize. And so I was visiting Naples, Italy. And this is so ironic. My mom never lets me forget it. My dad was born many years prior to the announcement of the prize. That is, he passed away many years prior to the prize, but he was born in the foothills of Mount Vesuvius in Napoli, or Naples. And I was here when the prize was announced. So needless to say, there was a lot of commotion in Naples. A couple of days I can't forget. But I stayed to give the lectures that I was invited to give, and then I went home and I was greeted by my medical students who were so happy and proud that their professor came back with a Nobel Prize, and they were hoping that I was not going to give any more exams for the rest of the course. I made them a little easier, but I still gave them the exams. And then we were invited a month later to go to the White House to meet the president. Here, my wife Sharon, who's an anesthesiologist. She's the real doctor, not like me. But we're waiting in the red room to meet the president. And who was the president in 1998? Bill Clinton. It was really a pleasure to meet him. You know, I'm kind of glad that I didn't get the Nobel Prize last year. If you know what I mean. So here we were taking some very nice photos. I remember this very well because while this photo, right after this photo was taken, I could see, or while it was being taken, I could see Hillary Clinton walking in the background. I wanted to see where she was going because I wanted to catch up with her to finish our discussions that we were having earlier on. And I must have turned around to look at her for maybe 2 or 3 seconds. That's all. Then I turned back around to look at Sharon, and this is what I find. Let me tell you something. Most of you know about this guy. I can tell you that from personal experience, he's faster than a speeding bullet. And the only thing more disconcerting about this is the expression on my wife's face. But it was all in fun. Then we're off a month later to Stockholm. The Nobel festivities are the first week in December. The actual Nobel Prize ceremony is on the anniversary of Alfred Nobel's passing, December 10th, every year. And it's hard to see this. I have a more close-up view, but this is the venue. So the Nobel laureates for this particular year are seated here. Behind us are Nobel laureates from prior years, well-known scientists, distinguished scientists as well. And on the right side are members of the different Nobel committees in medicine, physics, chemistry, literature, and so on. And up here was the Stockholm Philharmonic Orchestra, which played the most incredibly beautiful Baroque music for the entire ceremony. It was really great. Here's a close-up view. We have the three laureates in physics, John Popel in chemistry, then Bob, myself, and Fred. Then we have the Literature Prize winner, the Economic Sciences Prize winner. You can spot me immediately by just looking for the change in reflected light up here. And then the last slide I want to share with you is my favorite slide, of course, something I could never forget, and that is when I received the prize from King Carl Gustav of Sweden. It's really an amazing slide. Here's Fred Neurad looking on. And what I want you to remember from the slide is not necessarily my getting the prize, but I want you to look at what the king and I are standing on the carpet. We are standing on NO, nitric oxide. I think I'm going to stop here, and I want to thank you so much for your attention. You've been a great audience.